Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back the Saker for our quarterly discussion of the shift to a multipolar world. Every quarter when I come in, this shift has become so dense and so complex and so interesting and so sometimes exciting, sometimes scary, that I think I build a list and I think I can't wait to talk to the Saker. So Saker, we got a lot to talk about. Welcome to the Saleer Report.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure. And yes, there's a lot of ground to cover this time.
Well, you know, for the last 3 months in the American press, you know, every other headline is, well, the Russians did it.
Yeah.
The Russians are, in the American press, the Russians are becoming all powerful. So we've just had elections, and we have a really great discussion about what it means for Putin and what it means for the Russian sanctions and the relationship between the two countries. So tell us about the elections and what it means both for Putin and his administration, as well as our relationship with Russia.
Okay, but first I'll mention, when you say that the U.S. blames everything on Putin, you know that regularly makes it to the news on Russian TV where everybody laughs. They go, look how powerful we are. We influence now even the elections. We influence everything. So everybody's laughing about that. And say, we must be totally, you know, invincible if we're so powerful. We hack everybody. We really meddle with U.S. politics. Aren't we great? But they just laugh about that. Seriously, actually, the elections were very interesting because the party in power actually increased its share. I mean, it was a complete, total victory for the United Russia Party, which is actually very important, but it's often misunderstood in the West why it actually is important. And the reason for that is, remember, Russia is under sanctions, which are not really hurting Russia too much, but the fall in the price of oil has hurt Russia tremendously. And plus, as we've discussed, the Russian government under Medvedev, and specifically the economic bloc, so the Ministry of everything that's dealing with the economy, have done a pretty poor job, I would say. And as a result, there is definitely an economic crisis in Russia. That's the important fact. Now, why would a party in power during a time of crisis actually substantially increase the number of seats it has in a parliament? I mean, when people say that this is going to be a rubber stamp parliament, this is absolutely true. But this is exactly what the Russian people wanted. They wanted a rubber stamp parliament.
Right.
Because really what happened, it was a vote of confidence to Putin personally. That's the first thing that's the only reason why that kind of score was made by the ruling party. Because in reality, if you look at the popularity of pretty much all the other politicians, including those of the main party, they're not that popular at all. So it was really a referendum on Putin and on his stance. And from that point of view, he received a huge mandate from the people. Clearly, the vast majority is standing behind him. That sends two signals. First of all, of course, to the West, that the idea of sanctioning Russia somehow to trigger regime change by means of color revolution in response to an economic crisis completely failed. What happened was the opposite. People circled the wagons again around their president. And secondly, as I've mentioned on this show already in the past, the real opposition in Russia sits inside the Kremlin. It's the pro-Western, pro-IMF, Washington consensus types who are in the government of Medvedev. And to them it sends this very same signal. We stand behind Putin, so don't try something. So it was actually an extremely important election because it really reestablished the power of Putin personally.
Right. Now, let me just go back because I want to talk a little bit about the power of the lower oil price and the sanctions. We've had on the Saleer Report Jim Norman several times and Ann Williamson, and talked about how the West intentionally brought down the price of oil, manipulated the price of oil, managed it lower in the 80s for the purpose of bringing down the Soviet Union. It was essentially an act of national security targeted at trying to weaken the Russian government. And Jim's got a wonderful book called The Oil Card, and the oil card worked. It really did help to bring down the Soviet machinery. And so this is a tactic that's been used very successfully by the West. And I'm not trying to say that the oil price coming down, that the only reason has to do with the Soviet Union, because there are plenty of things going on in the energy industry and with technology to bring the oil price down as well. So, but the reality is that tactic worked before, and this time it's not working. Is that fair to say?
I would say that it is working in an economic sense. I mean, Russia was most definitely hurt. They're actually discussing reducing the budget for the first time, including the finance minister is actually suggesting a 6%, I think, reduction in the military budget, which I don't think will happen. So it has worked in a sense of hurting Russia. That has hurt Russia way more than you know, the formal sanctions. But it failed politically because there's a completely different environment. For one thing, during the Soviet Union, there was really very little support for the Soviet state as it was. Whereas today, there's a completely different informational picture, I would say, in Russia. People get their information in a competitive market for information. You see all the Western, the blogosphere, and they clearly have come to the conclusion that this is a war. And in case of a war, once you're aware of that, you accept sacrifice, particularly the Russian people. And the party in power has a very easy argument to make. It says, do you want to surrender Crimea in order to get French cheese back on the market? And, 90% of the people say no. As a matter of fact, during those elections, another thing that was very interesting to see all the pro-Western parties, those who essentially, for instance, don't accept what's called the Crimea consensus, which is Crimea is ours, as they say in Russia. They scored about 3%. They couldn't even make a single person in parliament.
Right.
So politically, tactic completely failed. Economically, it worked.
The Russians experienced what happened when they embraced the West in the 90s.
Absolutely.
Right. So that was kind of an economic siege of Leningrad.
That was a huge, and that argument always comes up. You think we have it bad now? You want to go back to the 90s? That's one argument that Putin supporters are using to devastating effect. The second one is you look across the border in Ukraine.
Right. So there's one other point I wanted to bring up, and that is the fact that because I've had experience with the equivalent of the sanctions that the Russians are dealing with in the United States. When they want to bring pressure to bear, they know how to mess with the individual's finances, and they always go after the lieutenants. You try and take out the lieutenants before you try and take out the general. Mm-hmm. And if you had applied those sanctions in the United States, I assure you, it would have gone very differently. The speed at which our system is held together by how much money you're making this year or, certain kinds of approvals this year. So you're talking about sanctions being applied that if they'd been applied to the United States would have been highly successful, in my opinion, relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the comparison of how these tactics would have worked in the United States in the U.S. system versus how they're working in a Russian system says, you have a system that's in Russia that's being held together by a strategic plan, vision, values, where in the United States you have something that's held together by much more monetary and short-term alignments, not by a shared vision.
Yes, but in all fairness, Russians feel, and I think correctly, that they have absolutely nowhere to retreat. And what's happening right now is an existential war for survival. I think that if the American people felt similarly threatened and absolutely know that negotiation just didn't work and they have nowhere else to go, I think they would take sanctions too and just, take a last stand and say, we're not going to retreat anymore.
Right. Although I would say the media machine has been able to create a divide and conquer mentality when, in fact, there are large parts of the American population which are cornered.
Yes, that's true.
They're so busy dividing and conquering each other that they don't, to this day, they have not yet seen it together.
Yes, that's true.
Right. Okay, well, it's, I think it, now, when you listen to the people who I think of who relatively reflect the CIA line, like George Feeman at Stratford, you know, when you listen to him, he's very adamant that the sanctions are going to wear people down and they're going to get worn down and things are going to come apart. Now, is that line going to change, or are they just going to hold the line in the face of the doom elections? What are they saying about the doom elections?
Well, I don't know what Stratford said about the doom elections, but you have to understand that who do these people work for? Essentially, they really work for those who pay them, and they have to feed a specific line. And it has been a very distressing feature of the United States, you know, the Beltway community, the think tanks, etc., that they write things which have nothing to do with reality, and they keep on writing things which are just not based in reality for the sole purpose of feeding a political agenda or a financial agenda in many cases. I mean, that reminds me of when Obama said that the Russian economy is in tatters, you know. I think yesterday he spoke at the UN and said that Russia is trying to regain a past glory by military means, something similar. I mean, it's absolute nonsense, which is based in nothing. But, you know, as long as the people you're speaking to are willing to pay for it, they'll do it. But I think it's irrelevant. I mean, I can assure you that the sanctions are not having that effect at all. It's not only that the Duma elections show that the people stand behind, but even the economy is doing actually fairly well, and there's some hopes that the economy is going to go out of recession, if mildly, but fairly soon. That even if it doesn't, the staying power of the Russian people is absolutely huge, particularly when they're cornered. And they are cornered. That's the key thing. When they say the sanctions are working, I go, great. And what do you think the Russians will do in response to that? They have nothing to do. They don't have an option.
Well, but here's what's interesting. If you look at what they're doing in the area of financial payment systems or in the area of agriculture, any place where the sanction is biting, they're building up their own capacity, which I think long run will be very healthy for the economy.
Yes, absolutely. And there are sectors who are actually terrified that the sanctions might be lifted, which I don't think will happen in the future, or near future at least. But that's one of the concerns, particularly agriculture. They say they need 5 years of sanctions to really fully become competitive. But the thing is that the sanctions are infinitely made worse by the policies of the Medvedev government. I think that's where the real... Okay, we said, you know, the fall in oil prices has hurt Russia, true, but I would say the first thing that has hurt Russia is the policies, the economic policies of the Medvedev government have hurt Russia way more, because they're the Washington consensus type. They're still, you know, concerned about inflation. They want a ruble that's what do you call it in English? I have a blank now. You know, not fixed, but free-floating, sorry. And all these things, you know, high interest rates on borrowing inside Russia, still a very heavy dependence and imbrication into the Western economic system, all these things are not helpful. But I think that Putin does not have the means. I wrote an article about that, saying, you know, is a purge coming? Because I think what Putin is doing is actually preparing for a purge of that fifth column inside Russia, but I think he needs to have an unconditional support of the Russian people, and two, he needs to have the situation, he needs to prove that policy is wrong before being able to put other economists such as Sergei Glazyev and others in charge of a much more sovereignist economic policy. So all these phenomena are happening simultaneously.
Right. Well, if you look at what's happening with technology and energy, they need to be building up the local self-sufficiency in the economy in lots of different ways. Because I think as long as the political structure and the rest wants it to, the energy price is going to keep coming down. If you look at what's happening in renewables or other forms of related technologies like battery, they're just, you can project a long-term, you know, drop in the price of energy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's turn to Syria, because if there's any place where the U.S. Has or appears to have a real multiple personality disorder breakdown, it's almost painful to watch, even for me. So talk to us about what's been happening in Syria, what you think it means.
Well, I fully agree with you, first of all, that this is a case of multiple personality disorder. And a lot of experts, both Middle Eastern and Russians that I've listened to, really seem to think that the latest strike that the U.S. Air Force with a couple of other air forces, I think the Brits, the Australians participated in that, that broke the ceasefire, were actually a Pentagon sabotage of the negotiations that Kerry and Lavrov had conducted. I think it is actually possible that this is indeed the case. I mean, I think that what's happening in, and I already mentioned on that show that I think the U.S. government is extremely weak. And when you have an extremely weak government, agencies start to become comparatively more powerful and more independent. And there are literally competing interests. I think the United States does not have a single policy on Turkey, on Syria, on many other things. And if it is true, and I tend to think it probably is, that this was a military sabotage of a treaty, of, or let's say an agreement that Carter didn't want to have anything to do with, that shows an extremely advanced level of disorganization and essentially collapse of,
you said Carter,
of the empire. Ashton Carter, the Secretary of Defense.
Carter, right, okay, right. Well, my impression is that you have the President and Kerry basically saying, look, we need to reduce our financial and physical commitment to the Middle East. We're wasting enormous amounts of resource in the Middle East, and we need to get on with a multipolar world. And that has very dramatic implications for the people who make money on war. And so part of this tension is really between the military-industrial complex and the White House as to where our best strategic interests lie. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, but if I would slightly rephrase it. One very interesting analyst in Russia called Ishchenko has offered a theory, which I think I endorse, is that there is a huge fight happening inside the United States right now between two factions. One faction which wants to sacrifice the U.S. for the sake of the empire, and the second faction which wants to sacrifice the empire for the sake of the United States.
Right.
The first faction who wants to sacrifice the U.S. for the sake of empire are basically the neocons and everything that surround them. And the second faction, according to Ishchenko, and I'm not saying that for a fact that it's true, but he thinks, and I find that theory at least plausible, is that basically that's the power base of Trump. And if that's what's happening, we probably see that this struggle already taking place in Syria, because the U.S. has basically two options in Syria. Either withdraw and let go, or double down.
Right.
That's the risk. Do you double down at any cost, or do you realize, okay, this is not viable, I need to get a negotiated settlement? I think that's what's taking place there.
So you're saying the neocons are the faction behind Trump?
No, the opposite. That the neocons are the faction who wants to sacrifice the U.S. for the sake of the empire. It's
correct.
The faction that is the empire at all costs. Whereas the Trump people in that hypothesis would be those who say, forget the empire, let's save the United States.
Right, right.
And these are the people who would favor a negotiated solution pretty much everywhere. They realize that they cannot hold on to the empire, so the smartest thing to do, if you come to that realization, is to what you call in Russia, it's bringing down on step while stepping on the brakes, which is a controlled deconstruction of the empire, be it in the Ukraine, Syria, or the economy, China, etc. Negotiate a way and find some kind of way to make a compromise would be the way to save the United States. The neocon solution is crazy, which is basically double down everywhere, and if nothing works, use as much force as needed.
Now, exactly where are the neocons planning on living when it fails?
That is a good question that I, for the life of me, I can't answer. Maybe Israel. But Israel needs the U.S. too, so I'm not sure of that. I think they're actually deluded. I think they truly believe that they're invincible and that, you know, any problem can be solved by enough, by brute force and deception. And that could have worked, you know, for Panama and for Grenada and then even for Libya. But when you're dealing with even Iran, they couldn't do it. Forget about Russia or China.
Right. Well, I think part of Iran was had to do with China and Russia not being willing to tolerate, you know, whatever they wanted to do in Iran.
So, I don't think the U.S. military has what it takes to win a war against Iran even now, but even Iran by its own. I don't see a winning strategy. They can hurt Iran. They can bomb Iran. They can do all sorts of bad things. But can they either regime change or occupy, which is the only, I think, definition of victory? I don't think they could do either.
Well, I must confess, to this day, I still do not understand what the... I understand the global chessboard idea of being the hegemon in Eurasia. That makes sense to me. But if you look at how much time and money the Bush and Obama administration have spent in the Middle East, it looks to me like the Obama administration has been trying to get out pretty much since they went in. But if you look net-net at how much time and effort we've spent in Eurasia relative to what our best interests were globally, the whole picture doesn't make sense. I keep thinking there's missing information here. To this day, I still don't understand why Cheney did what he did, and I still think I'm missing information. So, to me, the picture is still not clear. But let's go back to Syria. What happens next in Syria?
Oh, that is a question. Well, first of all, it seems that the collapse of the ceasefire means back to, you know, at least short term, back to simple warfare. I would say that the conflict there will probably be frozen until the election, because right now, I don't think the U.S. has it in itself to take a major initiative to change something in a major way. The Russians certainly are not going to move either. I don't think the Iranians can. I don't see a military solution, you know, a quick one by nobody. Turkey has made a move which still is extremely controversial and unclear. I tend to think and agree with those who say that Turkey moved in with the knowledge and basically agreement with the Russians and the Iranians, even though the Turks might have done a little bit more than what they told the Iranians and the Russians they would do. Right now, I think it's a frozen conflict in the sense that I don't see a major change happening until the election. Because clearly, if Hillary comes to power, we know it's going to be war. I mean, it's going to be, and war probably involving the U.S. military at that point. I mean, actively. I would have to see that the chances of U.S. aircraft getting shot down by Russian missiles at that point would become extremely real. Would the U.S. then retaliate against Russia? Possibly. Anything could happen. If Trump comes to power, my biggest hope is that he would convene a sort of a long meeting with Putin, something like a Camp David, you know, week long, where he would try to find out and you know, outline some kind of negotiated, at least a dialogue towards negotiations on every single thing that opposes Russia and the U.S. right now. That would be, if I could recommend something to the U.S. president, that would be the first thing to do. Sit down and now try to find a compromise acceptable to all parties.
Well, let's step back, because if Clinton wins and or Trump wins, internally you're going to have first and foremost a real internal war. So
yes.
So let's just step through it. If Clinton wins, you're going to have a very, you know, both candidates have extremely large disapproval ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And if Clinton wins, you're going to have someone who the military, the enforcement, the intelligence bureaucracies view as someone who will take classified information, and they and their political appointees will use that information for their own personal financial rewards. So if you're the entire bureaucracy that has to implement national security, you are basically starting day one in a position where you don't trust anyone at the top. Now, when that happens in Washington and in the federal bureaucracies, people just freeze. When they decide to do passive aggressive, it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, can Clinton get the machinery to even act, other than obviously the neocons have influence in certain places, and obviously there's a whole installation of private defense contractors and mercenaries who I'm sure would be willing to act, you know, along the neocon lines. So the question is not just what will the policy be, but can the policy even be implemented? Because I think you're talking about massive, you know, at least in the media and from an economic warfare standpoint, you're talking about real civil war inside the country.
Possibly, but I'm not sure. I mean, the neocons completely control the media and Congress. So, you know, for a popular uprising or civil war or protest or sabotage or something, you need to have something triggering it. It usually is an informational element, you know. And in the good old days before the internet, when you did a military coup, the first thing you took after the government palace is the local TV stations. That's how important information is. And it's still important today, but it's... Is there enough of a blogosphere and internet to somehow coordinate or trigger a reaction? I'm not so sure. And the American public is extremely passive. People hate what's happening, but they don't see an alternative. The administration, people inside the bureaucracy, how could they possibly, react or sabotage? I don't know. I mean, the neocons have a pretty strong grip on power.
Right. So I'm not saying that they would go to the streets. I'm saying that they have a way of just requiring everything to be by the rule book. So when the Washington bureaucracy decides everything has to be impeccable according to the rule book, everything slows down by 90%. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, so but we have...
They
the
can
passive
aggressive...
They have been infiltrating the U.S. Power structure since at least the 90s.
Right.
So, you know, they have people everywhere at every single level that they're loyal to each other, and they will keep an eye on their colleagues. And if needed, they'll fire more people. I mean, that's what they've been doing for years now.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe I'm too pessimistic here.
I think there are a variety of different issues, one having to do with the federal bureaucracy and the other having to do with the state bureaucracies and how they respond to the federal bureaucracy doing something. Remember, the debt capacity is pretty much used up. Now, you can just keep printing paper, but we've been doing that for quite some time. And so the financial ramifications of the neocons going wild are much more extreme today than they are, and that's going to be important to the states. You go.
When I was in college, it was in the U.S. In the late 1980s, early 1990s, we gathered a group of graduate students, all specialized in national security affairs, and we had sort of a debate: what could bring down the established political system, the regime, to speak properly, in the United States? And we agreed that it would be an external factor, that internally the system is so good at handling dissent or disagreement or information or everything else that it's just we didn't see any circumstance under which change would come from within. Our conclusion was that it would be either an economic or a military shock from the outside. And
right.
I still tend to
right.
believe that. I think it would
right.
take, you know, a collapse of the dollar or a sunken American aircraft carrier to get a sort of a massive wake-up call with tremors inside the country. And even that would be hard, because there's always the ability to circle the wagons around the flag and do what happened after 9/11.
Right.
So it's a very tough proposition.
So let's say Trump wins. And I agree with you that, you know, the Trump faction is much more inclined to preserve the United States at the cost of empire. And I would say many of that group don't believe empire could ever work. It's just not feasible. So they win, you're still going to have enormous anger and disagreement, because Trump's disapproval ratings are very high. Mm-hmm. So both candidates have extremely high disapproval ratings. That means when they get in, it's very hard to implement any kind of policy that requires action.
Yes, but Trump's disapproval rating is based on things that he can easily prove. Not that I'm a Trump supporter, I'm not. Huh? But I think just some pragmatic, he's accused of being unstable that start a war. Well, he won't. His anti-Muslim rhetoric will run into legal difficulties anyways. You know, Mexico is not going to be a major problem. So really, there's not going to be, if you predict an apocalypse, and Trump comes to power and now apocalypse happens, I think his approval ratings might suddenly, his negative ratings might suddenly go down, particularly if Trump is smart and, does embark on a number of reforms which the people would approve of.
Here's the apocalypse. An apocalypse is going to happen. You have a whole world of people, I mean, a big world and an expensive world of people whose job has been to yakety yakety yak and justify a whole bunch of stuff for the unipolar vision. And, and that's a big group. And it's, I wrote one about the African American elites who surround Clinton. All those people, that whole gravy train is going to get shut down fast.
Yes.
And for those people, it is an apocalypse.
Yes, it is.
And it's one that I'm going to enjoy watching tremendously.
Agreed. If it happens, I'll be celebrating.
Anyway, but, I think they should all get jobs as cleaning ladies at Motel 6 and discover America and learn what it's like to earn a living in America. Anyway, so their gravy train would stop, and I would certainly enjoy that. Okay, so we just had the anniversary of 9/11, and you wrote a piece on 9/11, which I thought is excellent. We have it posted up at Solari.com. Tell us about the piece. Walk us through it. Tell us why you wrote it. Tell us where we are on 9/11.
Well, I wrote it just because of the anniversary. I wanted to sort of make a summary of how far we've gotten. What has the 9/11 truth movement achieved, in anything or not? And I broke it down into three, what's called the three A's, which are used in intelligence community to describe how ideally intelligence should work. The first A is acquisition, which is getting the data, getting the raw information. The second level is analysis. You take the data and you go through it by expert opinions and you evaluate it. And the last part is acceptance, where you go to the political authorities or the highest level inside the agency, and you submit that and they accept it or not. So if we go by that methodology, I would say the first part, the acquisition, was really the easiest part, and it was extremely well done. There were a number of difficulties initially because a lot of amateurs, mostly amateurs, were actually involved in the acquisition part, which is, the recordings, the interviews, all the raw data that's available about 9/11 and all its aspects. There was a huge amount of data. Some of it was very poorly analyzed. Others were pretty well analyzed. But at least the acquisition, that's easy. We have everything we can possibly want to know in terms of facts about 9/11. Everything is known.
So can I make a pitch about the amateurs?
Yeah,
I was one of the amateurs because in the beginning, there was a group of us. We had just had an event at the National Press Club for the GATA group, and there was a group of activists on 9/11 who asked me if I would help have a national press conference. And I said, well, there's no point in having a press conference. We need a process. We need a process of collecting information and data that's ongoing. And so what happened was we did do an event at the National Press Club, but we started a website in collaboration with a website, Scoop Media in New Zealand, called Unanswered Questions. And I said, look, the place this always falls down is you try and figure out what happens. We're not competent. We can't create an evidentiary trail. What we can do is we can ask questions, and we can say, look, we have questions. We can collect data. We can put it on the website, and we can evolve a process where we're all asking questions. Well, that started, and then part of that group started supporting Paul Thompson doing a timeline. And it went on for a couple of years, and it was amazing because it was phenomenally successful. Because if you just looked at the unanswered questions, it was clear that the official story was complete bunk.
Absolutely.
And they did a good job of collecting evidence. Now, here's what was amazing, because we were absolutely amateurs. We weren't you know, we didn't have the skills or the knowledge to get into a lot of the technical issues related to the buildings coming down or anything. But what happened was, which was amazing, was it held open the space. Mm-hmm. And by holding open the space and collecting enough data, that's when the architects, the engineers, the scientists, the pilots, they all started saying, wait a minute, this makes no sense.
You're absolutely correct.
And
that's exactly what happened.
It took several years to bring them in. And then when they came in, we all looked at each other and said, thank God the big boys have shown up.
Yep. But I mean, see, personally, it took me 8 years before I even start looking at having doubts about the official narrative. That's how personally, you know, blinded I was, because it really is that level of arrogance and cynicism is just inconceivable. So you reject it. I mean, I always thought, you know, the empire is the empire, but at least they're patriots of their own empire. So it is counterintuitive. And of course, initially, I couldn't be bothered with that because it just sounded a little ridiculous. But it is that acquisition of listing of questions where people say, oh, that makes no sense. And I looked at it, well, what do you mean it makes no sense? And the deeper I looked at it, the more I went, wait, this really doesn't make any sense. What is happening here? And I think it happened
exactly as you say.
The first level was amateurs asking questions, but also getting, you know, raw data. And then real specialists coming in, looking at it, and going, mm-hmm. you know, there's something wrong here, let's look at it deeper. And that's another thing, is the internet played a huge role, because normally just the acquisition part, you know, on a worldwide basis of people, because you could get the acquisition, you could acquire straight from the internet. You didn't even have to be in New York. And then the second part, the analysis by amateurs, some of them more or less enlightened, is something that normally would require a multi-billion dollar investigation. And here it was done by volunteers with zero costs. Or, you know, individually covered. So I think the second phase, then, the analysis, I would conclude is a stunning success. Because I think there is enough strong analysis that is, I would say, goes beyond, you can just deny the facts and ignore it. But if you look into what happened, there's a couple of things. I mean, for instance, the free fall World Trade Center 7, during 2.25 seconds is the one I prefer, which is basically means that 8 floors of building were removed instantaneously. That is something which is an amateur who was a teacher of physics in a high school forced NIST to admit, and NIST did admit that, which essentially means that the U.S. government admitted it was controlled demolition, because that's the only possible explanation for that. But there's also thermitic material that was discovered in the dust. There's also radar tracks which indicate that some of these planes had a course which could not have been plotted by a human being. And there's much more to it. I mean, now they have now a consensus list, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, has like 60 points or 40 points by now. We have more than enough. We have overwhelming evidence now backed by specialists, truly technically competent of absolutely undisputable reputation, who say, you know what, there's something here. So we're stuck on the third level, which is acceptance now. But the 911 truth movement cannot, and it's not its calling, to force acceptance. They're trying to do that. I mean, architects and engineers, they're trying to address more and more people. But really, if most people already doubt the official version, it even was won by the people. So what's left is the iron grip of the regime on the media, on Congress, on the bureaucracy, who forces everybody to shut up and not dare to raise the issue. So we push them down to their very last, you know, limit, which is brute force. They basically go, we're not going to engage you.
Okay, so
what are you going to do about it? That's what the government says. What are you going to do about it? There's nothing we can do right now. But that's a success.
Okay, so in the first minute of hearing, I didn't own a TV when 9/11 happened, but in the first second of hearing that it happened, I was 100% certain it was an inside job.
Wow.
It never occurred to me that anything else was possible. I'll tell you something very interesting, because I live in a very racially segregated community, and one of my cousin's African-American farmhands walked up to me the next morning and said, we think it was Bush. What do you think? And the African-American community assumed it was an inside job, whereas the Caucasian population you know, didn't come to that conclusion for, or didn't even dare think that for over a year. It was impossible for them to conceive that it could have been an inside job. So it was sort of, you know, the African American, or many, many people in the African American community, and me, and then everybody else. So, but here's the thing. If you go back, I would really encourage you, there's a DVD called New York, New York that PBS put out, and it describes the Triangle Fire. And if you watch that presentation of the Triangle Fire, what you'll see is that exactly the playbook of 9/11 has been done in New York before.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same exact playbook and the same exact result in terms of at that point it was getting legislation from the New York State Legislature, not the national legislature. But you know, this is a very old manual, and it's an old playbook, and it's been done many, many times before.
Yes.
And the American elites killing the American population, whether it's you know, with narcotics trafficking or nuclear testing or prototyping various biological things on the population. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time. And so killing, you know, the thing that was different about 9/11 that was they started to kill upper class people, which, you know, the Titanic and a few incidents aside hasn't been that common. But American elites have been killing Americans for a very long time. So it didn't surprise me at all. But the big reason it didn't surprise me was my focus for the 2 years, 3 years prior to that was on all the money going missing, essentially the financial coup d'etat. Mm-hmm. And to me, one of the reasons for 9/11 was to cover up the trail on a great deal of mortgage and securities fraud. I mean, remember, you're bringing down, in Building 7, you're bringing down Salomon Brothers. What was Salomon mm-hmm. Brothers? Salomon Brothers was, you know, one of the leading government and mortgage securities companies, and the lead investor was Warren Buffett, who has one of the largest insurance companies, who, what do they buy? They buy mortgage and government securities. So you're talking about bringing down and destroying the trail on a $40 trillion, at that point it wasn't $40 trillion, but $4 trillion at that point, missing from the federal government. So I don't know. To me, it looked like an inside job right away. So I'm shocked that you were trusting enough to believe that the American elites wouldn't kill Americans.
Well, remember, my idea of the elites then was the people I studied with and under in Washington, D.C., and the overwhelming majority of these Americans, mostly military, were patriots, were really true patriots.
Yes.
And
yes,
to me, I had to separate the government from the deep state. I still don't believe it's the U.S. government who did it as such. It was a deep state within the U.S. government. And unless the African-Americans, they deal with it, they think the entire government is basically, you know, hostile and cynical and lying and murderous. But most
You know why? You have to remember the African-Americans populate the bureaucracies in Washington, particularly at the lower level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for many generations, you had the janitors, the cleaning ladies who see all know all, you know, they sort through the trash. Mm-hmm. So their intelligence networks to get detailed information about what's going on is phenomenal. And they've built up, the community has built up ways of sharing it. So they look at things in a much more complex way, is my experience.
Well, I was basically naive. I mean, I could not believe that something so brazen could be done. I mean, I just, to me, it just blew my mind.
Well, one of my theories was, and I'll just throw it out there, because we've done a lot of work on entrainment technologies on the Saleri Report, and I think they're part of this. I had one subscriber who was putting up cell towers all over the country, mm-hmm. and there was a tremendous push that he couldn't explain. Rush, rush, rush. Putting up multiple towers in multiple places where it didn't make economic sense to have that many towers. And he kept talking to me about this makes no economic sense. And what I would discover is, you know, I kept driving by on the interstates because I was traveling so much, driving by towers that were basically compatible with the cell company that I was using at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing because the service wouldn't work. So it was clear that whether it was the economics or the service that that this was not just about providing cell service. And then in August 2001, he called me and he said, you're not going to believe this, but we just all got laid off. It's done. Whatever they're trying to do, it's done. And I said, uh-oh, something big's going to happen now. And I think the, you know, sort of you, when you watch everybody walking around in a trance, listening or talking on their phone, I think part of what they were hoping to do was get the entrainment technology really in place by the time they did it. And that was a real contributor to making it go.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Anyway, okay, so let's talk about, because we are in an election, and that election is getting pretty intense, and we're coming into the season, which is, you know, October is the most intense time in Washington every year, but in a presidential election, it's phenomenally tense, and we've seen Trump just slightly pull ahead in the polls, and you know, the disinformation and craziness around the election really going off the charts. Let's just say Trump wins. In your opinion, I asked you, what are the 10 most important steps if you're Donald Trump and you've become president you need to take?
Okay, well, I came up with 12, actually.
12 is
okay,
good. Let's
first,
do 12.
Internally, quick and easy, abolish ATF, DEA, abolish Patriot Act, abolish the Federal Reserve. That's just for starters. I would legalize the use of drugs.
Wait, start again, slow down. You would abolish the ATF?
The ATF, the DEA,
said?
Yes, the ATF, DEA, and the Federal Reserve.
Wait, DEA. Okay,
yes.
ATF, DEA, Federal Reserve, Patriot
repeal
Act.
Repeal the Patriot Act, legalize the use of drugs, or decriminalize it, similar to the use of alcohol. Then comes more complicated things. I would order a complete overhaul and re-regulation of the U.S. banking system and Wall Street to get it back under government control. But that would be a much more long process, which would require some kind of conference that would be it's much more complicated at that point, but I think it's essentially to recover what I call sovereignty, because I separate the countries are either run by the government or run by the corporate financial world. I think in this case in the United States, the people need to be back in control and wrestle away the sovereignty of the country from the big corporations. And replace Obamacare with a single-payer system is what I would recommend inside the United States.
Right.
Shall I go for the outside?
Yes, go.
I would go draft a new military doctrine for the United States, a defensive military doctrine, whose goal would be conceptually to draw down about 50% of all U.S. military forces abroad while remaining committed to allies, security of, you know, essential interests. Not a worldwide withdrawal, but I think a new military defensive posture.
So would you honor and respect current allied agreements?
Not all. I would abolish NATO, first thing I would do.
Okay.
I would scrap the ABM system in Europe.
Okay.
And then I would convene three conferences, and that's all within the same logic, which is I don't think it makes sense for the empire to double down. So if you don't double down, but you need to withdraw, you want a negotiated withdrawal and not a panicked flight. So I would say three things need to be done. First, a three-party conference on the Ukraine between the U.S., Russia, and select EU foreign ministers.
Okay.
The goals would be obvious, to replace the current regime with something civilized and basically get a donors conference and rebuild the Ukraine either as a confederate unitary state or, you know, if that has to go this way, as a number of successor states to an artificial entity. That would have to be negotiated. Second thing I would say...
Okay, so let me just play a bad guy on Ukraine. If you look at the per capita incomes of the Ukraine as of 5 years ago...
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian per capita income grew, Polish per capita income grew dramatically, and the Ukraine didn't.
Yes.
So there's an older, deeper, longer problem in the Ukraine. It's not just the last 5 years.
I completely agree with that. And if you want, we can discuss that or...
No, we don't have to hang on that, but... But you need a solution for the Ukraine that addresses that.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah.
My personal solution is to break it up into at least three or four successor states. I think it's the least bad one. But still, it would require humane effort of all parties. Second, international conference on the future of the Middle East with every single regional actor represented, including Iran.
Okay.
And the last one, an international conference on the future of the dollar and the international financial system. Again, this is to avoid a catastrophe and to negotiate a drawdown and retreat with all the interested parties.
Right. But if you retreat, what replaces it?
Oh, a multinational. In every single case, the underlying logic here that, you know, as long as you have a world hegemon, he is in charge of everything and has to carry the burden of everything. Here you pull in international actors and get them to share both the responsibility and the right to have to promote their own interests and visions of what's happening. So in the last three are clearly a direct. To me, it would be instead of fighting the multipolar world, it would be participate in its construction in order to secure the best place possible for the United States in it. Because it's going to happen whether the United States likes it or not.
Right. So here's the challenge. Let's say we go to a system where the central banks are basically clearing international currencies and we let the market decide. You now have a deep state that has accumulated enormous financial resources who can play that system in a lot of different ways. And so you're going to need international governmental cooperation to ensure the integrity of the digital and other systems, both hardware and software, and make sure the deep state can't do that.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're going to have some pretty frightening economic warfare. You're going to need a very high level of cooperation to make sure that the systems have integrity.
Yes, and that's why I think that tackling the deep state in the U.S. would be crucial, but also in other countries. I mean, the planet needs to wrestle back control over its finance and resources and economy from that tentacular multinational deep state, which is running, who has taken physically control of the main system that runs the planet. Absolutely, that is the purpose behind that. Basically, it's a paraphrase for saying deconstruction of empire again, because the deep state is what builds empire.
Well, it's really you're talking about an international effort of the lawful against the lawless.
Exactly.
So
that's as good a definition of a multipolar world as I've ever heard.
Right. And the question is, how are the lawful going to get together and make it attractive for the lawless to come over to a lawful side?
Well, because the lawless are inside every single country. So the countries need to go through a process of re-sovereignization. That's exactly what's happening in Russia right now. I do. The process is far from complete there, by the way. It's still an ongoing process. But that is what eventually real people who are patriotic, who love their countries, who are not imperialist, they have to do that internally, and then they have to join forces to force that upon the resistance. Right now, Russia and China are clearly cooperating against the U.S. But who are they cooperating against, really? They're cooperating against the U.S. deep state.
Right.
There could be, in theory, an American president who would find more interest in common with Russia and China than with the U.S. deep state.
Well, let me bring up two interesting recent events, which I categorize under the topic of cut and run. For many, many years, I've worked with reporters to get reporters to, and Cynthia McKinney did this in congressional testimony, and say, okay, who owns the contracts? Who has the contracts? Who's running the information and payment systems where these trillions of dollars are going missing? So up until 2001, we had $4 trillion go missing from DOD, HUD, and other government agencies.
Yeah.
Since then, because of the wars in the Middle East, a lot more has gone missing. And then we just had the Inspector General come out and say in 2015, $6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments on the books of the DOD for 2015. Now, here's what's very interesting. last year towards the, well, in January, Lockheed Martin announced that it was going to spin off its information systems, presumably including that DoD contract, I'm assuming it's included, to a new company that SAIC set up to spin out its information technology. So SAIC and Lockheed have now spun out their information systems into this new company. So it's off of their balance sheets. The liabilities are off of their balance sheets. And those contracts have gone into this new company. That was affected as of July. In August was when the DoD Inspector General came out and said, whoops, we're missing $6.5 trillion. So I posted a commentary called Lockheed Cuts and Runs, basically describing the fact that Lockheed has given up that PowerPoint, if you will, just to get the liabilities off their balance sheet, which tells me something's up in 2017 after the inauguration. That's a big cut and run.
It is. I was not aware of all that. Very interesting.
Right. So we now have over $12 trillion missing from the federal government. Now, I've always asserted that under the law, and there's case, and you know, there's case law on this point, that the Department of Justice can assert a common law right of offset against Lockheed and basically seize Lockheed all their assets. You know, if they're the contractor and all that money is going missing on their systems, and that is in violation of the Constitution and the laws and regulations related to financial, you know, whatever, and they have knowledge of it, which they obviously do, then they are liable for the full amount, is, you know, given past positions that the Department of Justice have taken with other contractors. So to me, that's a very big, important cut and run. Now let's talk about another cut and run that very much relates to Russia. If you look at where we were in 1995 and the vision of unipolar empire, a very important part of that was getting GMO seeds and Terminator seeds adopted globally. And so, in fact, we know that the Doha round, the Uruguay round, went into effect in 1995 with the creation of WTO. We know that the Doha round has stalled, and one of the biggest reasons it stalled was 200,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide and died trying to stop GMOs in India. Mm-hmm. And if anything has contributed to stopping GMOs globally, it's both Europe's resistance and now Russia outlawing GMOs and saying,
yes,
no way.
Yes,
right. And Putin has used this very effectively as a tactic, saying, you know, we're going to build, you know, a GMO-free agricultural industry. You know, it's a great it's a great business because non-GMO is growing and fresh, and organic is growing gangbusters. It's one of the great growth areas in the global economy. Anyway, so now we have Monsanto, because what Monsanto did in the United States is it went out and it, whether using the law and trying to force legal adoption of Terminator seed or market adoption, it got very aggressive about trying to force farmers onto their model of GMO seeds and then their pesticides. That drove the cost of seed up dramatically. While we were in the commodity super cycle, farmers could afford it. Now with commodities crashing, the seed prices are absolutely driving them out of business. Monsanto is in real political trouble, their stock way down. We finally just saw the Germans agree to take them over at a 44% premium. So basically the Germans are buying out Monsanto. I don't know how they're going to do the legal organization and what that means of stripping those liabilities out of the balance sheet, but whether it's a name change or stripping out those liabilities, it sure looks like another cut and run to me.
And do the Germans have any economic interest really behind that, or is it a political, is the U.S. basically just using Germany as a way to cut and run?
I think the Germans are looking at, you know, China bought Syngenta, and China just announced, I think it's a $450 billion, or it's a huge commitment to revolutionizing agriculture over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, and Monsanto has a lot of intellectual capital in the agricultural area, so I think the Germans see this as a very important part of the future. I also think that if you look at the German, you know, what some people call the Fourth Reich. They have an absolute interest in making sure these liabilities are managed. So that could be a piece of it. To me, it's murky, but it's definitely, there is definitely an aspect of cut and run.
Right. Well, what concerns the first example you gave, Russia has very much a similar problem of corruption in the military-industrial sector. I mean, they've been fighting it now for a while, and I don't think it's solved. I think it improved. But that, again, that proves that really, you know, governments and the people have common problems and common interests. And what this is going to look like in Russia is, there's an expression in Russian, you say, you know, it's an iron, what do you call that in English? Broom, an iron broom. What's needed is basically an iron broom, and that's basically it's a symbol for a merciless crackdown on corruption. And that's, again, that's that crackdown on corruption where money disappears is a fundamental national security interest for every state that wants to be sovereign and not to be, you know, a host for a parasitic group of people. Again, the interests are similar. If Russia and the U.S. collaborated, you know, it would be a heck of a lot simpler for them to work together than to fight each other while they're both affected by the same kind of parasite.
Well, I think if you look at the financial coup d'etat here, it was $40 trillion before the $6.5 trillion announced. So let's say we're up to $45 or $50 trillion. You know, if you look at how much it's drawing out of the economy, let alone the trillion a year plus for military expenditures and costs worldwide. Mm-hmm. Because of new technology, we're in a very powerfully deflationary stage. Mm-hmm. And we've levered up with debt, and we've used that debt to finance things that are not economically productive, or this disappearing money. So whether it's the, let's call it the black budget, whether it's the black budget tax, or, you know, the tax of having a corrupt aristocracy, you know, it's been enormous, and we financed it with more and more government debt. And there's a great quote I keep using from the German finance minister Schwabel saying in Shanghai in February at the G20 meeting, the debt finance growth model is over. There are no shortcuts that aren't reform. What he's saying is you can't kick the can with more debt. The reality is, you know, you have to get down to issues of what's economic and what's productive and what's not. And my whole second quarter wrap-up, I'm going to send you a hard copy this week, is on these issues of productivity and how do we get to real productivity. And the reality is when you've run out of debt capacity and you can't keep growing debt and you're deflating, and I assure you, when you deflate your balance sheet, your income statement, your expense items, it becomes that much harder to cover your debt service, let alone the black budget tax. And so these issues have to come to a head, not just in Russia and the United States, but everywhere.
Yes.
And what I see is that, you know, we're all thinking in terms of Russia versus the United States. We're not thinking in terms of the lawful versus the lawless, mm-hmm. and bringing transparency to these issues. So how do we get the lawful together globally? I think that's what you meant when you said Trump should pull these international conferences together, because what you're basically saying is he should get the lawful together globally to have this conversation.
Yes, we could call it the lawful, we could call it the sovereign, or you know, those who want to be parasite-free, but it's all the same thing. It's basically, right. We all see that whatever aspect you look at, the empire is crumbling. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. It's going to be replaced by something else because it's unsustainable. So the best way of making that something else happen is to jointly manage that transition and try to make it, you know, least catastrophic, least painful possible, though it will be hard anyways, and to get some kind of pulling forces together to go over a very difficult and potentially dangerous, because this is a major transition period.
Right.
And it's, of course, an extremely dangerous one because it's planetary.
Right. Well, I used to have a deputy when I worked in government who used to say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new.
Mm-hmm.
And what he was pointing out is when you take down a system, you need a clear vision of where you're going, because you can't like take down one and then bring, it's not a two-step process, it's a one-step process. So you really, it's like judo, you really need to know where you want to go when you make a defensive move, because in fact the defense is the offense. So it seems to me we need a vision of what could be a highly productive, highly wealth-building way of managing this planet together.
But for that, we need to ditch the predominant ideology for that has been, you know, ruling for at least the past 50 years, if not more. So that's going to be extremely hard to do, because we have an entire class of people, you know, that has a vested interest in that. I mean, the empire is so strong because the minority which benefits from it is so big.
Right.
You know, it's not 10 people. It's much more.
Right.
So, and they hold the instruments of power. So that's where the danger comes in. The danger
right.
is doubling down. When it's a doubling down on an unsustainable policy results in a catastrophe, literally.
Right. Well, I'll never forget, I was in London in 2002, and I was being shrieked at by a guy from the Pentagon who was screaming at me about how dare I talk about the $4 trillion missing money. And what I realized, it was very interesting, Sikr, I realized, oh, you know, his wife works at IBM, he works and is a longtime bureaucrat at DOD, and what he thinks is his pension fund is good no matter how much money they steal.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, and it is, as long as you can double down on the whole planet and make them play. You know, play and pay. And if you can't, then, you know something, then all money is real. And guess what? You don't get, you know, your pension fund doesn't work either.
Yeah.
If the, you know, so it's a little bit like the Titanic. Everybody thinks that they can, you know, their deck chairs are good as long as they're government guaranteed. Well, that's fine as long as the ship is floating. But when the ship's not floating, guess what? We all go down. So,
but in order to maybe try to protect the ship, it is important to give that Pentagon guy some kind of way out. Not necessarily what
right.
everything he wants, but if we
right.
corner that guy, he will fight to the very last end too.
Right.
That's why compromise
right. well,
is
absolutely.
So important.
What you, right. What you want to say is, look, you know, during the last 20 years, you know, corruption worked. It was the strategy that worked. You know, but now that's over. Now you need to come back and, you know, do this. So I agree with you. You've got to make it attractive for as many people as possible to jump ship and
yes.
and go with a new system. Right.
And you've just essentially summarized what Putin has been doing since he came to power. That's why he goes on slow step and reforms and doesn't go into huge purges or, you know, massive grand actions like in a movie, because he has to offer some way out to all the people who were interested in the old, let's say, 1990s kind of Russia. Some you can negotiate with, some you can't, and it's going to be the same in the United States. Some people probably will accept that a transition is needed. Others, the hardcore, will have to be dealt with by this, you know, iron broom that I mentioned. But you
right.
want to have that group that who will resist down to the last one as small as possible and as weak as possible.
Well, one of the reasons that I'm so adamant on the Saleri report about the importance of, whether it's your time or your money or your vote, always supporting good leadership, is what I know there is a tremendous number of competent people in the leadership who've been pushed to the side because they didn't want to go along with the corruption.
Yes.
And the general population supported the corruption.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
And we can't afford to lose that portion. And so shifting support and realizing they're there, if we'll just, you know, if the general population will shift and shift individually with their own money, their own time, their own everything. And part of that is just turning off the media machinery, because the media machinery I see as being one of the most negative influences here.
I agree 100,000% with that. And I was just about to say that this is where Putin began. The first thing he did, it's not true that he took control of the media. No, but he got rid of the fifth columnists in the media. Not all of them, but a good 80-90% were basically removed quietly, nicely, with some packages and negotiated and he got rid of them. And right now, the public opinion in the U.S. needs to be, I mean, the media is the number one target and the number one enemy. And Trump, if he ever gets to power, I hope will have to do something about it. Because that's where, that's as you said, that is the first level. As long as the media continues to say that black is white and, you know, wet is dry, and then hot is cold, this is going to be extraordinarily hard. Because you need people's right. support for reforms. And therefore the media, which right now is a completely, totally in bed with the neocon agenda and the imperial worldview, they will have, the key people there will have to be fired and replaced by people. Again, that's the iron broom. It has to start with the media. Then everything else,
well,
the media becomes reasonable. Even Congress will calm down.
I think, Saker, it's not just the media. I think it's the telcos. Because if you look at the entrainment technology and the sort of trance state that everybody's getting put in, that's, you know, that's the hardware and the software. So it's not just the media companies, it's the telcos. And that's a deeper, you know, you're talking about your entire communication infrastructure is being manipulated in ways which are very dangerous to any kind of lawful agenda. So that's why I call it, I don't know if you've seen the perfectly horrible movie, The Kingsman, but that's why I call it
yes.
The Kingsman.
Yes, you've mentioned that to me.
Campaign, yeah. There's another movie too with John Cusack called, I think, Cell, and it's the same thing, you know, billionaires using SIM cards to manipulate people's minds and you know, basically trick them in a variety of ways. Okay, well, it's interesting. I just looked at the latest Gallup poll, and interestingly enough, Congress's approval rating is even lower than the media, which surprised me. Well, tell us about what you're going to be up to for the next 3 months. You know, we regularly post the links of what you're writing, but obviously your site is thriving and doing well. So tell us about what you're going to be up to for the next 3 months.
I think the main event in the next 3 months is obviously going to be the election. And I will try to look at it from the aspect of how it impacts internationally and how people are lining up. It's very interesting for me to observe. First of all, not only am I for the first time truly interested in one, but I love to follow how that election is viewed abroad and how foreign specialists, you know, how they align. And it's amazing. The consensus against Hillary Clinton is, I would say, total. I mean, it's quite
really?
Of course, yeah, oh yeah. Among real specialists, yes. Everybody says Clinton, maybe. Trump, they're not sure about Trump, but they're horrified by Clinton.
That well, is, you know, let's talk about this. It's very interesting. I was down in Australia in the springtime and was at a meeting that is organized by the group from Australia who go to the World Economic Forum. So they go to Davos and the World Economic Forum, and then they come back and do a Australia-focused meeting, and then they invite some outsiders in to kind of inspire thoughts. I was one of the outsiders. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating because there were so many people there who I talked with, who I liked tremendously, who were terrified by Trump and thought Clinton was okay. And what I kept saying to them is, look, if Clinton's okay with you, then it's hopeless because we're talking about a criminal system and there's no hope.
Yeah, but you're
so
I'm not here
to promote
country.
Trump. Right, but they really thought that Brexit and Clinton were one and it was a referendum on globalization. And I kept saying, no. We don't have a problem with globalization. We have a problem with centralization when it's inefficient and corrupt.
Right.
So we have a problem with lawlessness. We have a problem with corruption. Globalization doesn't have to be corrupt, and it doesn't have to be lawless. Mm-hmm. But we have a real problem with uneconomic centralization, and that's what's got to stop. And if globalization is going to involve uneconomic centralization and corruption and promoting people like Clinton, then you're going to walk into, you know, we're all going to walk into a wall. So we're going to have to stop and revisit centralization versus decentralization and lawfulness versus lawlessness. Mm-hmm. And I would say that they, you know, that the global image of Clinton was so completely different than the reality that it was just a little bit frightening.
I have to say that when I mentioned foreign experts that I was listening to talk about countries, you know, Russia, China, Iran, Latin America, Europe. That's where I'm looking at. So it's probably not the same sample as what you would have seen in Australia.
Well, but here's what I saw in Australia and in the United States. The reality of the Clintons has always been kept off among this, you know, it's always been kept off as sort of the right-wing conspiracy. And for the first time now, we're seeing all of that bust through, and I think a lot of it was the Bernie Sanders supporters, and now the reality of Clinton is becoming a bipartisan understanding, whereas before it was really kept off and poo-pooed as fringe, and now I think folks are looking at what happened in Haiti and looking at the money in the foundation and looking at the emails and saying, wait a minute, you know, this is corruption, this is lawlessness, this is something else.
I sure hope so. I mean, I am still very frightened because my impression is that as long as the media is going to be in lockstep with Clinton, it's going to take one heck of an effort to counteract that. But I sure hope so because in the countries that I follow, the consensus is, you know, God preserve us from Hillary because then all the bets are off. I mean, that's what pretty everybody's saying. Whereas Trump, they're dubious. They don't like him, but they at least go maybe.
Right. So Clinton wins. What happens day one in China and Russia?
More of what has been already happening now. I mean, I will be honest. Russia has been preparing for war for the past several years, actually. Very, very actively preparing for war. I mean, down to the level that even banks had an exercise as how they would function during a conflict. Yeah, recently, that's even they are preparing for war. And I think the Chinese are doing exactly the same thing because they're assuming that their only chance to survive a Clinton presidency would be strong enough to even for her to not to think of directly attacking them. So it's everyday military exercises, joint military exercises, civil defense preparation, you know, restructuring of the emergency ministries and the state security ministries and everything that has to do with emergencies, preparation for war. And they're just going to accelerate if Clinton gets there. Because I think they don't have any other option. It's not that they're particularly, you know, hell-bent on war. It's that they literally have no other option. That's what I would be doing, too. If you were told you're going to enter a cage with a rabbit tiger inside, you would get the biggest gun you can. That's what they're doing.
Right. So as you know, I believe that Brexit was basically the British saying, we want to get out of the arrangements with the U.S. before Clinton gets elected and before this gets any worse. So it was basically the Anglo-American alliance coming apart at a very deep level. Has the British vote for Brexit changed what's happening? Because I see that couldn't have happened without England making a deal with China.
I don't know. That's your area of expertise. I'm not aware of and have no reason to believe or disbelieve an English negotiation with China. Really, I tend to think that this was a surprise for the British elites. I see no signs of that having been negotiated or kind of prepared. I think they were caught off guard by it. But I might well be mistaken. I'm not a UK specialist.
Oh, I think the Queen very much wanted to come apart. And so I don't think the aristocracy was of one mind, but I think the Queen, if you look at who, you know, Boris Johnson, Nigel I'm going to mispronounce his name, Farage, you know, if you look at their effort, someone was behind that. So I think it was very much top down, and part of it came out of the meetings. I'm not saying that there was a direct negotiation with China about it, but there was a very big meeting in China in the first quarter of China meeting with the English, and you know, the comments were coming out. We're ancient cultures, not everybody is, and a real direct dig on the United States. So I think I think England wants to move forward with a multipolar world and thinks the neocon agenda is nuts and they don't want to be brought down by it.
So, well, what's certain is that for the British to cut as much as to disengage themselves as much as possible from the sinking EU is a very sound thing.
Right. Right.
I mean, the closer you integrate with that sinking ship, the most likely you're going to go to the bottom. So even at that point, I would see also a similar interest. You know, people who say, let's protect our financial interest here and forget about this ideological construct that the EU was.
Right. Right, but I think part of the EU construct is related to the relationships with the U.S.
Yes, absolutely.
And the unipolar vision.
Yeah, the U.S. modeled the EU, absolutely.
Right. Well, okay. Anything else we need to know to follow you in the next quarter? Give us your website again and
it's thesaker in one word .is is like in Iceland. Thesakeris is where you can get the main website, and there are a number of sites in other languages that you can also follow. You know, Latin American in Spanish, and there's one in Italian and in German. And in French, so there are a bunch of different languages, and they're all part of one community. So I encourage you to. And there's a very good one in Australia. So that's the Oceania Sacred blog, which I recommend you also to check out.
Okay, well, you're blossoming like a garden, Sacred. I can't thank you enough for doing these quarterly reports and for your website and all the work you're doing. It really gives us a view. It's so important to understand the shift to a multipolar world. It's been going on for quite a while. It's going to keep going on. As you said, it's a very important and deep change. And so I can't thank you enough. We really appreciate your help with it. So you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. It's always an honor and a pleasure. And I wish you and all the listeners also a wonderful day. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.